You're listening to KBOO KBOO Portland. KBOO is an independent, member-supported, non-commercial, volunteer-powered community radio station. By making a donation through GiveGuide on kboo.fm/give, you're eligible for over $4,000 worth of free and discounted products from your favorite Portland brands. Next up is Transpositive.
Thank you, baby. Just wanna take a little time out to you. Thank you, baby.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for contributing to KBOO's membership drive. And we couldn't have done it without you.
Thank you for your post, for your like, for your click. Tumation needs a TTT.
They didn't decide how they can protect the animals or the environment or people more. Instead, they were like, well, how can we protect ourselves? And from that, they developed these protocols where prior to any large storm event, they're actually now locking all animals inside, boarding up the facilities and bolt locking them with multiple different devices so that nobody can get in and nobody can get out.
You were just listening to Elizabeth Jones, also known as Ethically Elizabeth. She is an animal rights activist, a rescuer, marine biologist, and a conservationist. You can catch this episode of Voices for the Animals on December 27th at 10 a.m. right here on KBOO, or anytime after the 27th on kboo.fm/voicesfortheanimals, also on Google Play and iTunes.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Transpositive. Let's introduce ourselves first. I'm Nicolette, and I use A&M pronouns.
And I'm Jean Bryant. I use she and her pronouns.
I'm Corey Gallet de Saint-Aurin, and I use he and him pronouns.
I'm Jess Guerriero. I use they, them pronouns.
Great. Our guests tonight are Corey and Jess, and they are here to talk about a recent study that they, I think, participated in, or however you describe it, at OHSU. To start off, why don't you both introduce yourselves and tell us a little bit about yourselves, your organization, and what you do?
Sure. This is Jess. I am a social worker for OHSU's Transgender Health Program, where I am the patient-facing social worker and help folks navigate through the system, get connected to care. And I'd say probably about 60% of my job is dedicated to pediatrics and working with youth and their families, both within our clinic and around the state, to make sure they're getting the care that they need. And that was one of the reasons why we participated in the Oregon Health Authority's grant to survey youth around the state, 13 to 21, to get a sense of what gender diverse youth need.
So this is Corey. I am a medical student at OHSU, and I am also a volunteer at the Transgender Health Program and the Dornbecker Gender Clinic. I got involved in this project actually because I had a prior relationship with the Dornbecker Gender Clinic's medical director, Dr. Kara Connolly, when I was working as a patient advocate in Florida at the University of Florida Youth Gender Program. And so through that connection, when this project came about, I wanted to give my full support to the project because working with trans youth, especially in rural areas, is something that has been a passion of mine for quite a few years.
All right, great. So can you tell us about this study you recently published?
Sure. So back in May, we submitted a request for a proposal to the Oregon Health Authority. It was a mini grant that they offered to a variety of organizations to assess a variety of needs of youth around the state. And they awarded us the grant, and we had about a 3-month turnaround to do a needs assessment, essentially. And largely Corey, we really couldn't have done this without him. He developed a survey that we were able to distribute at Pride festivals and whatnot during the month of June and collect data from over 200 youth throughout the state. And then based on that information, we went out to non-Portland metro areas, Eugene, Coos Bay, Bend, and Medford were our focus areas, to conduct focus groups and individual interviews to get first-person feedback on what the survey had discovered. Do you want to talk, Corey, about some of the highlights?
Sure. So in the focus groups, we basically sat down with trans youth that we had found through various community partners, and we were able to ask them questions that really got to the heart of what their daily life is like in their communities, not only in regards to their physical health care, but their mental health care, their emotional well-being as well. And it really was an opportunity for us to try to raise their voices and bring that information back to the Oregon Health Authority so they are aware of the things that trans youth are going through, especially when it comes to things like what their not only their school environments are like, but also like if they're able to get, you know, non-trans related health care as well, if they feel safe accessing mental health care, or just a basic thing is just going to the doctor for a checkup.
Yeah, and some of the highlights were that we asked the question of, are you getting care for transition-related needs? And nearly 3/4 of folks responded that they weren't. And that was pretty shocking to us. And potentially not surprisingly, the leading reason why youth felt like they weren't getting the care that they needed was because of lack of family support, mm-hmm. And secondarily, lack of insurance coverage, or at least lack of awareness of what insurance coverage would look like. We also found that pets and friends were some of the most supportive factors in folks' lives, and people often responded that they were interested in moving forward and keep living because they had a cat that they can talk to every night.
Aww.
And yeah, power of the animals for sure.
Oh yeah, I know how that is. All right. So what kinds of care do you think transgender and non-binary youth might need access to?
Everything from basic primary care with a provider who is going to at the very least affirm their gender, all the way up through comprehensive surgical care in some cases, or at least a doctor who knows how to refer for that care. Definitely mental health support, both with individual counselors, family therapists, crisis teams that are aware of the specific needs for gender diverse youth, and then community and social support are key, whether that's in a group format, more like group therapy, or more of a low-key social drop-in where someone can assume a reasonable amount of safety. I think those were some of the main highlights.
I think the biggest thing to take away from what we learned is that just overall there was a lack of access to care and a lack of providers, but it wasn't necessarily only in terms of gender affirming care. I think the thing that really stuck with most of the members of the team is that there's just having youth feel safe just to go to get, you know, a regular checkup or even to seek an antidepressant, for example, that there, in a lot of the communities, there really wasn't more than one option of provider. So if they didn't feel safe or comfortable with that particular provider, they really didn't have too much of a choice there.
Mm. Yeah, and really outside of the Portland area, when someone is looking for the more comprehensive, complex surgical services, there's one surgeon that we're aware of in Bend, for instance. Mm-hmm. And so we are more than happy to take care of folks around the state, but we recognize the burden of travel, and especially when there's not family support on board, that can really be a huge barrier for youth who are trying to seek more specific gender-affirming care.
May I make an observation?
Go ahead.
As a question? I realize that, you know, my level of awareness is going to be higher than maybe, you know, some folks that may be listening. But so far, everything that I've heard that you were able to glean from the focus groups and from your survey, basically none of it comes as any measure of surprise.
Right.
They're all pretty well assumed, though perhaps not well documented, issues. Mm-hmm. So with that lead-in and observation, basically two questions. Did anything that you learned and heard come as an actual surprise? Is there news here, even if, though it may be nuanced? And secondly, I had a question of your sampling. The youth that you were able to engage with, were these out? Were these folks all out? Were they known, say, to their families? Had they come out, or not? Or, you know, what kind of a mix did you have?
Yeah.
What kind of a mix did you have?
Yeah. So I think there were three things that were surprising to us. One was, you know, we know there's a lack of access to care for sure, but the percentage of the folks who responded to the survey who felt like they weren't getting the care that they needed was, I would say, higher than we expected.
Mm-hmm.
Especially because the demographics seemed to suggest that we were gathering information from youth who were in more urban environments. So that was number one. Number two is actually pretty sad, and I think it sat with all of us pretty heavily for a while. But we asked an open-ended question of what do you fear the most? And nearly a third of the folks who responded to the survey said that they feared that they would be murdered because of their identity. And, you know, I don't think that that's something that adults think youth think about, even though we know that the larger cultural soup that we swim in certainly has those narratives. You just have to sign on to Facebook and you see that for sure. And then the other thing that was sort of an antidote to that statistic was that despite these hardships, these youth had really, really amazing goals and dreams. And I think the picture of gender diverse youth often suggests that, you know, they're thinking about death and suicide pretty frequently, and that is certainly a reality, but there's also this other beautiful, rich, resilient side of things that really was amazing to capture, because we're always trying to figure out how to bottle up resilience and give it to people. And I think these youth were certainly a good demonstration of what that looks like.
Something else that was maybe anecdotal, but still, as somebody, you know, looking into these things, that was positive and affirming was also that, you know, in these smaller towns in Oregon where you have, you know, adults who are stepping up and who are running, you know, a drop-in center, for example, and giving kids a safe place to go and a non-judgmental place to go and just an environment that they can be themselves after school. And it kind of also leads into your second question there about, you know, what does the demographic look like of who responded. So the first part of our project dealt actually with an anonymous online survey, and that was quite a few. I'm going to say it was 185 responses or so.
I think it was over 200 and then close to 190 or something complete surveys.
There you go.
Yeah.
And now with those responses, you know, we can't really know what their level of out status necessarily was, because that wasn't really something that we, like, we cared about how they identified and their identity, but we didn't really necessarily ascertain, like, how that was interacting with, you know, their family or their community. However, when we did focus groups, then we could get in a lot more, you know, intimate details about participants in that type of setting. And one thing that came up was that some of them, for example, had been, you know, misplaced because of their out status. So they, you know, they were living with people other than their parents because of that. And there were people who were not out in the focus groups, and there were also people who were newly out, you know, I mean, within just a few months. So it really was quite a wide variety of people's experiences. One thing I also did want to mention is that we know that there are so many more youth out there that we were unable to reach. And, you know, if the opportunity presents itself, we would still like to make sure that their voices continue to be elevated and find a way to reach even further into the corners of the state, because, you know, that can be really important to make sure that especially when it comes to policy, you know, with the Oregon Health Authority, that they're understanding what's really going on with these youth.
Yeah, and the link to our survey is still live. So even though we're not actively crunching the data and submitting it for formal reports at this point, it is still accessible, and folks can email me at transhealth@ohsu.edu if they're interested in getting connected to that link. And if we have more people power, we can obviously take a look at that data and see, as more responses come in, how that shifts and changes things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I got to say, I was sadly not too surprised when I read those findings about how many were so afraid of abuse, because, I mean, I and pretty much every other trans or non-binary person I know have, you know, experienced abuse, assault, harassment, and bullying for our gender identity or presentation. And that I think brings up an interesting point, that it seems to me a lot of people are trying to make it harder and harder to transition, because there seems to be this idea these days that, especially among trans youth and non-binary people, that apparently being trans is just a trend and people are pretending to be trans because they think it looks cool. But clearly, with the way that people are treating trans people, it just doesn't really make sense. It's clearly not something that's seen by society as cool. People are being, you know, abused and assaulted and murdered for being trans. It's not something that someone would choose willingly, I don't think. I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think... Sorry.
Yeah. No, go ahead.
So I think, yes, this is a societal and a cultural problem. It's not located within any individual. And I think that is, I think it's part of the grief process, honestly, when parents, caregivers, family members bring that particular argument up. And it's kind of that denial bargaining stages of grief, if you're thinking of it from a clinical lens. It also brings in sort of the idea of ageism and how we know from data that the brain is not developed until 25 and blah, blah, blah. And that's certainly something to consider, but the insistence and the persistence and the consistency that these youth are bringing forward, even if they're only able to start talking about it at age 16, 17, because that's the first time that they've got the language or they feel like there's some airtime. There's still a lived experience that they had prior to that. And I think one of the more powerful things about that statistic around fear is that folks are pushing through and asking to be affirmed and asking for the care that they need, even in the face of that fear. And that's pretty powerful. The other thing I would actually argue is that, yes, there are so many people who are not getting the care that they need. And at the same time, our program, and particularly in pediatrics, we have seen just astronomical growth in terms of the number of referrals. From 2006, when we first started tracking care related to a gender dysphoria diagnosis, mm-hmm. through now, it's pretty remarkable. And as Corey suggested, we have the Dornbecker Gender Clinic under the direction of Dr. Kara Conley, and she has really, in partnership with Amy Penkin, who is the program supervisor for Transgender Health Program, the two of them have really rallied the institution to launch a dedicated gender clinic that is now happening every Friday out in the Beaverton area. And it's a multidisciplinary clinic where families have access to social work, psychology, the endocrinologist, and nursing, all in one space. And we also have 4 new patient appointments available a week. And so that's really increasing access for folks. So they're having to wait less time. And so there's less opportunity for things to get in the way of them coming through the door.
All right. So you had mentioned that, you know, you found about 3/4 of the respondents had received no medical care for their transition or for trans-related medical care. Do you have any ideas as to what reasons may be the case? I know you listed a couple.
Well, one thing to remember just about any trans or non-binary person, regardless of their age, is that, you know, transition looks different for everybody, mm-hmm. and also people's desires look different. And so, you know, there's probably a percentage in there that maybe the reason they hadn't sought care is maybe they don't want to. Right. And that's, you know, perfectly okay. And then there are lots of other unfortunate realities that people face. For instance, transportation, financial cost, insurance issues, parental support. One thing that is a little bit unique in the state of Oregon compared to some other states, for example, is actually the age of medical consent is 15. And, you know, I previously come from a place where the age of medical consent was 18. And for a trans young person, you know, 3 years of being able to make those decisions, that can add up to a lot in the long run. So, I mean, those are all like varied reasons.
Yeah, and just to clarify, from our program's standpoint, we really try to practice from a family-centered family systems model where it is a shared decision. So when it is possible, we try to engage an adult caregiver in the process, because what we know from places like the Family Acceptance Project and our colleagues up at the University of Washington is when there is a supportive adult on board, youth do better. And it's really a protective factor. So that's kind of our basic starting point. We also recognize that waiting for care is not a neutral option. So we're kind of thinking about it from a harm reduction standpoint and considering all the factors. And in some cases, if a youth is estranged from their family or if the psychological distress is so great, we will talk with them about what it might look like at the age of 15, 16 to move forward with a medical transition if they do not have the support of an adult in their life.
All right. Yeah. Yeah. I remember, I think the study found that it was a quarter of trans and non-binary youth have families that rarely or never support their identity, which, I mean, that may be a lower number than it was in the past, but it's still a large number, and it's still a major problem for a lot of reasons. It sounds like you consider this to be a barrier for trans youth to receive the services they need. Is that accurate?
The lack of support from families?
Yeah.
Yes, definitely. Youth are dependent upon the adults in their lives, and for all the reasons that Corey described, mm-hmm. transportation and financial support.
Yeah.
Having the cell phone that's connected to the medical chart, and so if we call to schedule an appointment, not passing the message along, things like that. So certainly family support and supporting families so that they can support their youth feels like a really important intervention that I know our group is interested in partnering with key folks around the state on trying to figure out how to tackle that issue. And I know that our dear friends in the OHSU and Portland community, the Staubs, Lon and Chris, have really been at the center of pushing for more support in schools. And Addie's Act was passed this year to mandate that schools have policies around suicide prevention. And I think the momentum and energy around that paired with the findings that we've had with the survey, I feel hopeful that we can start making some inroads. We're not trying to change anyone's specific belief system, but I think we can all agree that a common goal is keeping our youth safe, and sometimes that means stretching our belief systems to understand that safety for someone might be affirming their gender identity, even if it goes against a religious or cultural belief system.
I mean, we already know that just the simple act of using someone's name and pronouns is a suicide reduction
strategy.
Strategy, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, and what we also discovered, with some of the youth in our focus groups was that wasn't necessarily always happening in their school environments. And that's a little bit concerning to try to understand how we can, a youth that is growing up in Portland and a youth that's growing up, say, in Coos Bay, that they can both expect and receive respect when they go to school, and just having their identity affirmed in that environment. It's a small step, but a very important one.
Yeah. Well, an observation here is, though they are inextricably linked to the general wellness and well-being question, it's kind of a leap to go from the healthcare system to the school system to, any number of influences here and contexts. And what I'm also understanding and hearing and seeing is that at least one of the steps towards addressing some of these other things is education. What has OHSU's trans health program done? Can you give us some examples of outreach and providing educational opportunities to healthcare providers and the broader community in some of these rural areas outside the Portland metro area?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Jean. So for starters, our pediatric endocrinologists go to outreach clinics around the state and in Washington. So we've got Coos Bay, Bend, Eugene, Salem, Medford, Klamath Falls, and Vancouver. So I feel like just the presence of those folks in those areas sets the tone. They're known as a resource. The people who are in the clinics that they're practicing in are exposed to that information, see our forms. You know, the medical assistants and nurses have to kind of raise the tide of knowledge, so to speak. So that's kind of the interpersonal, smaller scale of the reach and influence. But in the past few years, we have done a training in Southern Oregon where Dr. Conley, Dr. Christiansen from Gabriel Park Family Medicine, and Amy and I went down to Medford, and we participated in a two-day training summit around sexual orientation and gender identity. And we also have done now a two-part training in the Bend area last June, and then Allison Fox from Richmond Family Medicine, Dr. Conley and I went down to Bend to do an intensive medical and mental health training. And we are in the process. I went out to Eastern Oregon and did a brief segment on trans care. Well, actually, it wasn't even on trans care. It was kind of basic trans 101, trans people exist kind of thing. And we are in talks to go back to Eastern Oregon in the spring and do a much more in-depth training summit. And I know our colleagues at Legacy, Dr. Karen Selva and Clancy Roberts, who's a social worker out there, went out to Coos Bay and did a day training. So it's definitely something that we are committed to and that we value and try to center amongst the other activities that we're doing, knowing that if the general knowledge in a youth's area is higher, then it might mean that they don't have to travel all the way up here. And I think Bend is a really great example. The primary care pediatricians down there have really stepped up to provide a lot of this care. And often what they'll do is maybe send folks up here for one consultation and then continue the care down there.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
So, you know, for those of us that live in the community here in the Portland metro area, no offense, but that seems like not a lot. I mean, it doesn't seem like a lot. And so my question for you is that a funding and / staffing issue? Is it a lack of general support? Is it resistance from the, or you know, all of the above? I mean, it seems like for as enlightened as, you know, Portland and OHSU is, that seems to be lagging a little bit in this particular aspect of trans care.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's all of that. I think it's particular communities being receptive to us coming down there, anywhere from having a space to host it to having a local group that's willing to fund it. Mm-hmm. And it certainly is a capacity issue with our staffing. Amy and I are the only two paid staff members for the entire transgender health program. And we've added two psychologists, but everyone else, including the psychologists, are clinicians. And so they are expected to be in clinic a certain number of hours per week. And it's that balance, right? If they step away from clinic to do a training, then the patients who are already in the pipeline are getting delayed in their care. And so it really is... We need more staff.
It's a dilemma.
We need I would say, a training coordinator who can assist with the administrative burden of going back and forth and finding the dates and finding the venue and making travel arrangements and, you know, making sure that we're reimbursed for our time, knowing that a lot of these organizations that are welcoming us down there don't have a lot of funding. And so how do we find that balance?
Yeah.
Because we want the knowledge to be out there. And one way to show commitment and value to this work and our communities is to put the money where the mouth is.
Yeah.
So
now I have one more, because I know you have more questions, Nicola.
Can I just add one thing?
Yeah, sure.
Sorry. One other thing that I also want to point out, just from the, like, the medical student side of things is that just in general, a lot of providers who are out there practicing, you know, when they were being trained and being educated, you know, the idea of caring for a transgender person or non-binary person never came up. And so a lot of the providers that are out there, especially the ones that are, you know, in a small town by themselves who are trying their best to provide care to the community, they're having to kind of come up with all the resources on their own. They're having to take their own time. For example, you know, I knew a provider who literally educated himself entirely on the topic by doing his research, going to conferences. It just wasn't a thing that was presented at all in his formal training. Now, things are starting to change for the positive. You know, at OHSU, the trans health program really does step up and fill that void. And when they are given the opportunities in the curriculums, they really embrace those chances to interact with students and to really make all students understand, regardless of what type of medicine that they want to go into, you know, about what the needs are of transgender patients. But, you know, that isn't necessarily the case all over the country, and not every doctor, for example, that's practicing in Oregon even went to OHSU for medical school.
Right.
So, you know, we just have this kind of knowledge gap, unfortunately, and so it's just definitely another thing that is contributing to kind of a barrier for this care expanding at a faster rate.
Yeah,
and I'll add one other thing too is we don't want to be the big Portland org that kind of drops in and then steps out, and there's no continuity. We know there are local champions in primary care, specialty care, and mental health environments. And as much as possible, we want to partner with those folks and center their voices so that we can be more in the background as a support and consultation body for them to do the work in the communities that they exist in. You know, as a self-proclaimed city kid, I know that there is sometimes a cultural gap when I go to some of these more rural places, and I'm very clear about that limitation of mine and what my bias might be and what other people's opinions or biases against me might be. But somehow we need to work together to help bridge these gaps and make sure that the folks who are practicing in these communities are equipped with the support of, say, the local coordinated care organization through Oregon Health Plan, or the school system, or you know, the major mental health agency down there, so that they can do the work that they're passionate about and knowledgeable about without necessarily having to have the big Portland presence come down there. Mm-hmm. Although we know that we have a lot to offer, given that we are building towards a center of excellence.
Yeah. Well, along those lines, I'm aware that OHSU conducted or hosted or established its first, I think, annual, hopefully an annual, like seminar, continuing medical education.
Yes.
for healthcare providers.
Yep.
For them to come here for a day or two for a highly intensive, you know, hours and hours and hours, full day long into the evening type of session. That's pretty recent, just from this summer, I think.
Yeah, we held that back in September, and Amy may have words for me tomorrow, but I think our intention is to make it an annual event, knowing that it's not always possible for us to travel somewhere, but people like coming up to Portland, and so that can be an incentive.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
What we tried to do was keep it as low cost as possible so that folks who really needed the knowledge could attend and then take it back to their local communities. Mm-hmm. And it was an intensive, everything from kind of level setting with an introduction to trauma-informed care in the context of gender-affirming care, to very, very specific information about surgical care, recovery, specific behavioral health strategies, and teaching folks how to do assessments for letters of support and whatnot.
Yeah. Thank you, Nicolette.
All right. So I guess what I want to touch on next, I know I've seen an awful lot of people seem to assume that there are like 5-year-old children being put through like reassignment surgery and hormones and all of that, which we know that that's just not what happens. And
unless they're intersex.
Right, unless they're intersex. Cis people don't seem to care when intersex are forced into life-altering decisions. I'm just saying, okay? Anyway, they go, oh my God, these little children that are identifying as trans and are allowed to identify that way, they're being forced to make these life-altering decisions. It's not like they're actually doing anything life-altering. At most, like the most common medical option for trans patients under 18 is hormone blockers, which is designed to delay puberty until the patient is an adult and can make a decision whether to transition or not. And thus, if they do decide to transition, then they won't have developed any secondary sex characteristics that may be irreversible and can cause them a lot of dysphoria. And if they decide not to transition, then they can just stop taking the blockers and go through a normal puberty. But I know you had also mentioned in your study that most health insurance plans don't cover hormone blockers. So can you talk about, you know, how this may affect trans youth who wish to transition, or how it affected respondents in your study?
Sure. I think more and more actually insurance companies are covering these, but what the barrier is more around the financial cost, especially for someone who is on a commercial health plan. In some cases, you know, it could be between $1,500 to $4,000 per injection, and so that is certainly a barrier. And really, I think one of the other barriers is just youth development and awareness of themselves and ability to talk about things, and then the receptiveness of the caregivers in their lives to make some proactive steps forward, because there really is a critical period for bringing pubertal suppression on board. And we'll just say it's roughly in the 10 to 12 age range, which is also, if you think about youth development, middle school, when youth stop talking to their parents. So there's just this paradox here. But if the suppression can be brought on board in that time period, then you're right. Yes, the secondary sex characteristics can be halted and prevented from further development, which, if you think about chest development for folks who are assigned female at birth, the only corrective mechanism at that point, once the chest tissue grows, is binding, which has its own health risks, and then surgical procedures. And then for folks who were assigned male at birth, once the face starts to be exposed to the effects of testosterone, then laser hair removal, electrolysis is the only way to permanently remove or reduce facial hair, and then surgery is the only way to alter the structure of the face. When we start seeing, I mean, the average age in our clinic is about 15. So usually when folks are 15, they have gone through a majority of puberty. And so at that point, the conversation shifts more to how can we give you a hormone environment that is going to bring the secondary sex characteristics that you are wanting, while thinking about the other steps that you could take to reverse or reduce the presence of the natal secondary sex characteristics. So
I think one thing that is also alarming, just in terms of this specific medication that you're talking about, is that in the past I had a patient family that I worked with, and they couldn't get coverage, and they end up doing mail order via Canada. Mm-hmm. And it brought their costs down from something like $3,500 every 3 months to $700 every 3 months. And that was just because of having something shipped over the border, so to speak. So I think there's so many complexities and intricacies when it comes to certain types of medications. And one thing that we know is that people that have used puberal suppression, their surgical outcomes are drastically reduced because of the lack of development, as you said, of secondary sex characteristics. So, I mean, in the long run, it just seems like this is another thing that we as a society really need to think about, as far as, like, you know, what are our priorities when it comes to taking care of people.
Yeah, and I think the key thing to know about the medications are that they are reversible. So as you said, as soon as they're removed, someone picks up exactly where they left off in puberty, and it presses the pause button, and it buys someone time to further explore their identity. And honestly, I think it buys the adults in a young person's life time to transition along with their young person. But when it comes to someone who is pre-pubertal and hasn't shown any signs of puberty, the only intervention is affirmation. And that, again, goes back to the family system and the school system. And we practice from a gender-affirming approach, which basically means following the child's lead, offering them a variety of toys, activities, clothing, so that they can really explore an expansive gender identity. And I think many young people, particularly, you know, in the 5 to 10-year-old range, can be hyper-focused on sort of stereotypical masculine and feminine behavior. And it's only until later in life that they start to have a more expansive understanding of what gender can look like. And then we often get the question of when is the right time to socially transition? And it really is, I mean, and when is the right time to medically transition? And it really is individual. And we coach families on thinking about their young person's level of understanding of what the world looks like, of their stated gender identity, how long they've been talking about it, what words they're using to talk about it. Some of our youngest patients are the ones that are using the most powerful language, like God made a mistake, or I am a boy, I am a girl, I'm going to grow up to be a woman, I'm a unicorn, something in between. Mm-hmm. And then we're thinking about the level of distress that they're experiencing, and if a social transition can be made, how does that relieve their distress? And then what the timeline would look like going forward if and when medical interventions are brought on board.
Some people might be surprised to learn that one of the biggest time points after puberty of where a transgender non-binary child might get into distress is actually when they start kindergarten. Mm-hmm. And that has just a lot to do with the societal expectations that we put on kids, and having to kind of fit into a role that they may not be comfortable with or may not have ever had to kind of conform to before. Because a lot of, like, for example, preschool educators are very lenient when it comes to play and gender roles, but then all of a sudden, you know, when it's time to get a big boy desk where we have to, like, actually sit in a chair all day, then the expectations that are put on us on how to behave, you know, the girls' line and the boys' line, or, you know, the boys play on the football field while the girls are supposed to go on the swings. Those kind of gender stereotypes get reinforced all over the classroom. And for some kids, that can really be, you know, a time where things get really amplified.
It certainly was for me.
It was for me too. I remember specifically in, like, kindergarten.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, when I started getting this idea of what boys are and what girls are, I remember thinking, well, society sees me as a girl, or and maybe not those words, but people see me as a girl, so I'm supposed to be a girl, and what people think girls are supposed to be. But I always had this feeling I was not a girl or a boy, and I just didn't even know if that was a thing, but I always knew it. you know.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So I want to go back to the point of, you know, how some trans youth simply don't want to transition, or maybe not physically transition, but they may still socially transition. And that's for both non-binary and binary trans people. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing wrong with that. Contrary to popular belief, you don't have to transition to be transgender. You don't even have to have gender dysphoria to be transgender. You know, there are even binary trans people who don't have gender dysphoria. But where I'm going with this is one of the many misconceptions I see about non-binary people is that we don't have gender dysphoria. And I am a non-binary person who does have gender dysphoria. So, I would like the type of transition. I would like to transition if the type of transition I want actually existed, but it doesn't, sadly. But, you know, there are other non-binary people who want to transition in ways that are currently scientifically possible. But I'm wondering, do you think that, you know, their identity as non-binary may also make it harder to receive trans-related health care compared to binary trans people?
I guess the short answer is yes. Largely, as you suggested, because, there are just limitations to medicine, right? If someone who is non-binary goes on pubertal suppression at age 10, we have several patients who are like, yes, this is the body that I want forever. But pubertal suppression is not a forever medication on its own. And after, you know, 2-3 years or so, there starts to be some concern about the lack of hormones in the body and long-term bone health and things like that. So there are some providers who are starting to work with their patients around, microdosing and low dosing of hormones, so that there are some changes to the body, but maybe not as extensive as someone who's interested in a more binary presentation. But there are just limitations in terms of what hormones do and don't do, and you can't really pick and choose from that menu of options. And then when you start talking about surgical procedures, there are certainly some modifications that can be offered, a mastectomy without nipple grafts, for instance, for some non-binary folks. But we do occasionally get some requests where the level of surgical risk to someone's overall health would just be far too great, or it's just not possible given the structures of the body and the way that skin works to create the thing that someone wants or the image that they have in their mind. I also think that because there is often this tension for non-binary people and particularly for non-binary youth where they're like, oh, I have to pick one, or I have to tell a story that sounds convincing so that I get the care that I need. There's also a limitation there because folks are not showing up as their authentic selves because they think that they have to perform this story and may choose something because it's what's available, but it's not actually in true alignment with how they see themselves in the world. I think I'll leave it at that.
One thing I also just wanted to mention that sometimes can get left out of this discussion, especially since, you know, we're here in Portland and, you know, the awareness of non-binary people is much higher than in other parts of the state. You know, when someone is living in a rural environment, sometimes it's not necessarily to say that they don't want to have a non-binary transition, but it may be that, yes, it's not safe. The fact that they may not have the understanding that it's even kind of an option because it's just not something that's in their dialogue and their vocabulary of the community that they live in. So we kind of have to consider those other things as well, as far as, you know, safety, unfortunately, is still a very big issue. I mean, regardless for all, trans and non-binary people, but when you're living in a rural setting, you have to think about it even more so.
Yeah, and we have some of our older patients who will come in and say, you know, I just learned about this non-binary thing, and it's actually more in alignment with who I am. And had this been an identity that I could have explored as a younger person, I may not have had, or I may not have gone on testosterone, but I would have had top surgery. And so there can be some sadness there, some regret. And I think that's also a piece that providers need to be aware of, and family and friends, because I think people freak out when they hear sadness or ambivalence around someone's transition story. But with the way that science and language and cultural understanding of gender is changing, at least in white Western society, we have to acknowledge that gender expansiveness has existed in non-white cultures as long as humans have existed. But I digress.
That is very true, though.
Yeah. But I think we have to recognize that because science and medicine and language and society are changing on what feels like a rapid basis, we have to give folks permission to continue to explore their identities and adjust accordingly. It's a tension. It's a tension between people who are supporting their loved ones and, oh, but you told me to use male pronouns and I worked really hard to do that. And now you're saying use they, them. And man, you know, just pick one, right? And I think that comes from our own people too. Like, there are folks in trans communities who feel threatened by non-binary folks because it undermines their affirmed identity, or guilty by association if they're stealth and are with a gender fluid non-binary person. And the messages that are out there that folks are not trans enough.
I've definitely seen that a lot. So we have just a few minutes left. Do either of you have any final thoughts before we have to go?
I have so many, but...
Well, maybe I should go first.
Yeah,
then.
Go for it.
You know, we recently started another phase of analysis, actually, where we were lucky to find an epidemiologist who is just as interested and passionate about helping trans youth as the people who were originally on this team. So I guess my final thoughts is that, you know, we're not done yet. You know, and if anybody has any ideas for making money rain from the sky, please let us know. Because honestly, that is probably our biggest limit and you know, continuing this dive to help the trans youth in the state of Oregon.
So. Yeah. We need accomplices in this work across all gender identities, cisgender, transgender, unicorns, non-binary folks. I believe in partnership. I believe in centering certainly the voices of trans and non-binary community members. But we need the strength in numbers, especially in this political environment. So if you're interested, join with us. We certainly need some moneymakers and folks to sponsor this work. And then we are in very, very early discussions about putting together some sort of summit where we gather key stakeholders from around the state, community voices, folks from DHS, folks from Oregon Youth Authority, Oregon Health Authority, the school system, school-based health centers, et cetera, to get together and really be a think tank to figure out what the next steps going forward are.
All right. Well,
great discussion.
Yeah, great discussion. Thank you both so much for being on the show. You were both wonderful, and this was a very great discussion. So that's about it for the night. You guys have been listening to Trans Positive. Once again, I'm Nicolette.
I'm Jean.
I'm Corey.
I'm Jess.
All right. We hope you have a wonderful night and happy holidays. Good night, everyone.
listening to KBOO, K-B-O-O, Portland. KBOO is an independent, member-supported, non-commercial, volunteer-powered community radio station. By making a donation through GiveGuide on kboo.fm/give, you're eligible for over $4,000 worth of free and discounted products from your favorite Portland brands. Next up is Calculated Conversation.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the SJAC Holiday Fundraiser and Open Hours Launch Party on Sunday, December 29th from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Social Justice Action Center in Portland. The Social Justice Action Center provides community space, access to a commercial kitchen, and now new open hours. The launch party will provide information about new programs, opportunities to volunteer, and more. Again, that's the SJAC Holiday Fundraiser and Open Hours Launch Party on Sunday, December 29th at the Social Justice Action Center, 400 Southeast 12th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Crackpots Holiday Pop-Up in St. John's. Open Thursday through Sunday, noon to 7 p.m., through Sunday, December 22nd, at the former Bank of America building in North Portland. The Crackpots Pop-Up Shop features 50 local upcycling artists and many curated items rescued from the waste stream by Reclaim It. Again, that's the Crackpots Holiday Pop-Up in St. John's, Thursday through Sunday, noon to 7 p.m., through Sunday, December 22nd, at the former Bank of America building.